The following program is a production of Sight into Sound Radio. Hello and welcome to the 10th reading of All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Dewar. I'm Jim Abate. Before we begin, let me explain that the book is read in its entirety and that some of the reading may contain explicit descriptions that some people could find objectionable. For those of you who did not hear the last reading of this book, let me bring you up to date. In our last reading, using the transmitter, the transceiver, and triangulation methods, Werner was able to find Bolkheimer from a distance of over 2 kilometers. In Saint-Malo, Madame Manette and her cronies decide to do small things to irritate the Germans, as the Old Ladies' Resistance Club. Madames Rouet and Guibault rearrange street signs, the women misprint a train schedule, lose an important-looking letter from Berlin, and other things. Sergeant Major von Rumpel has a biopsy taken. Following beatings, Friedrich is sent to Leipzig for surgery and does not return. Marie-Laure's father writes letters to her, telling her he is safe and being well-fed. Arl Bazine took Marie-Laure and Madame Manette to a small grotto where the walls are lined with hundreds, if not thousands, of snails and mussels. Marie-Laure loves it. Arl gives her the keys which open the gate to the grotto. Bolkheimer has graduated, and Friedrich has not returned. Some of Werner's transceivers are being used in the field, and some of those come back for Werner to repair. At the Hotel Dieu, Madame Manette and Marie-Laure met with a man called René. She and her friends will help gather information for the resistance. Madame Manette is trying to recruit Etienne to read and transmit numbers from his attic radio. Arl Bazine has gone missing, and we now continue with All the Light We Cannot See. Everything poisoned. New silk banners hang above the refectory tables, ablaze with slogans. They say, disgrace is not to fall, but to lie. They say, be slim and slender, as fast as a greyhound, as tough as leather, as hard as crump steel. Every few weeks another instructor vanishes, sucked up into the engine of the war. New instructors, elderly townsmen of unreliable sobriety and disposition, are brought in. All of them, Werner notices, are in some way broken. They limp, or are blind in one eye, or their faces are lopsided from strokes or the previous war. The cadets show less respect to the new instructors, who in turn have shorter tempers, and soon the school feels to Werner like a grenade with its pin pulled. Strange things start happening with the electricity. Goes out for 15 minutes, then surges. Clocks run fast, light bulbs brighten, flare, and pop, and send a soft rain of glass falling into the corridors. Days of darkness ensue, the switches dead, the grid empty, the bunk rooms and the showers become icy. For lighting, the caretaker resorts to torches and candles. All the gasoline is going to the war, and few cars come trundling through the school gates. Food is delivered by the same withered mule, its ribs showing as it drags its cart. More than once, Werner slices the sausage on his plate to find pink worms squirming inside. The uniforms of the new cadets are stiffer and cheaper than his own. No longer do they have access to live ammunition for marksmanship. Werner would not be surprised if Bastion started handing out rocks and sticks. And yet, all the news is good. We are at the gates to the Caucasus, proclaims Hauptmann's radio. We have taken oil fields. We will take Svalbard. We move with astounding speed. 5,700 Russians killed, 45 Germans lost. Every 6 or 7 days, the same 2 pallid casualty assistance officers enter the refectory, and 400 faces go ashen from the effort of not turning to watch. The boys move only their eyes, only their thoughts, tracking in their minds the passage of the 2 officers as they move between tables, seeking out the next boy whose father has been killed. The cadet they stop behind often tries to pretend that he doesn't notice their presence. He puts his fork in his mouth and chews, and usually it is then that the taller officer, a sergeant, sets a hand on the boy's shoulder. The boy looks up at them with a full mouth and an unsteady face and follows the officers out, and the big oak double doors creak shut, and the lunchroom slowly exhales and edges back to life. Reinhard Volkmann's father falls. Carl Westerholzer's father falls. Martin Burkhard's father falls. And Martin tells everybody, on the very same night his shoulder is tapped, that he is happy.
"Doesn't everything," he says, "die at last and too soon? Who would not be honored to fall, to be a paving stone on the road to final victory?"
Werner looks for uneasiness in Martin's eyes but cannot find it. For Werner, doubts turn up regularly. Racial purity, political purity. Bastian speaks to a horror of any sort of corruption. And yet, Werner wonders in the dead of night, isn't life a kind of corruption? A child is born, and the world sets in upon it, taking things from it, stuffing things into it. Each bite of food, each particle of light entering the eye. The body can never be pure. But this is what the commandant insists upon. Why the Reich measures their noses, clocks their hair color. The entropy of a closed system never decreases. At night, Werner stares up at Friedrich's bunk, the thin slats, the miserable stained mattress. Another new boy sleeps up there, Dieter Ferdinand, a small muscular kid from Frankfurt who does everything he is told with a terrifying ferocity. Someone coughs. Someone else moans. A train sounds its lonesome whistle somewhere out beyond the lakes. To the east, always the trains move to the east, beyond the rims of the hills. They go to the huge trodden borderlands of the front. Even as he sleeps, the trains are moving, the catapults of history rattling past. Werner laces his boots and sings the songs and marches the marches, acting less out of duty than out of a time-worn desire to be dutiful. Bastian walks the rows of boys at their dinners. What's worse than death, boys? Some poor cadet is called to attention. Cowardice! Cowardice, agrees Bastian, and the boy sits while the commandant slogs forward, nodding to himself, pleased. Lately, the commandant speaks more and more intimately of the Führer and the latest thing, prayers, petroleum, loyalty that he requires. The Führer requires trustworthiness, electricity, boot leather. Werner is beginning to see, approaching his 16th birthday, that what the Führer really requires is boys, great rows of them walking to the conveyor belt to climb on. Give up cream for the Führer, sleep for the Führer, aluminum for the Führer. Give up Reinhard Volkmann's father and Carl Westerhose's father and Martin Burkhard's father. In March 1942, Dr. Hauptmann calls Werner into his office. Half-packed crates litter the floor. The hounds are nowhere to be seen. The little man paces, and it is not until Werner announces himself that Hauptmann stops. He looks as if he is slowly being engulfed by something beyond his control.
"I have been called to Berlin. They want me to continue my work there."
Hauptmann lifts an hourglass from a shelf and sets it in a crate, and his pale, silver-tipped fingers hang in the air.
"It will be as you dreamed, sir. The best equipment, the best minds."
"That is all," says Dr. Hauptmann.
Werner steps into the hall, out on the snow-dusted quad 31st formers, jog in place, their breath showing in the short-lived plumes. Chubby, slick-chinned, abominable Bastian yells something. He raises one short arm and the boys turn on their heels, raises their rifles above their heads and runs faster in place, their knees flashing in the moonlight. Visitors. The electric bell rings at number 4 Rue Vaubarais. Etienne Leblanc, Madame Manec, and Marie Laure stop chewing at the same time, each thinking, "They have found me out. The transmitter in the attic, the women in the kitchen, the 100 trips to the beach." Etienne says,
You are expecting someone?
Madame Manek says, no one.
The women would come to the kitchen door. The bell rings again. All three go to the foyer. Madame Manek opens the door. French policemen, two of them. They are there, they explain, at the request of the Natural History Museum in Paris. The jarring of their boot heels on the boards of the foyer seems loud enough to shatter the windows. The first one is eating something, an apple, Marie-Laure decides. The second smells of shaving balm and roasted meat, as if they have been feasting. All five, Etienne, Marie-Laure, Madame Manek, and the two men, sit in the kitchen around the square table. The men refuse a bowl of stew. The first clears his throat.
Right or wrong, he says, he has been convicted of theft and conspiracy.
All prisoners, political or otherwise, says the second, are forced to labor, even if they have not been sentenced to eat. The museum has written to wardens and prison directors all over Germany. We do not yet know exactly which prison. We believe it could be Bretignon. We are certain they did not hold a proper tribunal.
Etienne's voice comes spiraling up from beside Marie-Laure.
Is that a good prison? I mean, one of the better ones.
I'm afraid there are no good German prisons.
A truck passes in the street. The sea folds onto the Plage du Mont 50 yards away. She thinks, they just say words, and what are words but sounds these men shape out of breath, weightless vapors they send into the air of the kitchen to dissipate and die. She says,
you have come all this way to tell us things we already know?
Madame Manek takes her hand. Etienne murmurs,
we did not know about this place called Bretignon.
The first policeman says,
you told the museum he has managed to smuggle out two letters.
The second,
may we see them?
Off goes Etienne, content to believe that someone is on the job. Marie-Laure ought to be happy too, but something makes her suspicious. She remembers something her father said back in Paris, on the first night of the invasion, as they waited for a train. Everyone is looking out for himself. The first policeman snaps flesh off his apple with his teeth. Are they looking at her? To be so close to them makes her feel faint. Etienne returns with both letters, and she can hear the men passing the pages back and forth.
Did he speak of anything before he left?
Of any particular activities or errands we should be aware of?
Their French is good, very Parisian, but who knows where their loyalties lie. If your same blood doesn't run in the arms and legs of the person you're next to, you can't trust anything. Everything feels compressed and submarine to Marie-Laure just then, as if the five of them have been submerged into a murky aquarium overfull of fish, and their fins keep bumping as they shift about. She says,
my father is not a thief.
Madame Manek's hand squeezes hers.
Etienne says, he seemed concerned for his job, for his daughter, for France, of course. Who wouldn't be?
Mademoiselle, says the first man.
He is talking directly to Marie-Laure.
Was there no specific thing he mentioned?
Nothing.
He had many keys at the museum.
He turned in his keys before he left?
May we look at whatever he brought here with him?
The second man adds,
his bags, perhaps.
He took his rucksack with him, says Marie-Laure, when the director asked him to return.
May we look anyway?
Marie-Laure can feel the gravity in the room increase. What do they hope to find? She imagines the radio equipment high above her, microphone, transceiver, all those dials and switches and cables. Etienne says,
you may.
They go into every room, third floor, fourth, fifth. On the sixth, they stand in her grandfather's old bedroom and open the huge wardrobe with its heavy doors, and cross the hall and stand over the model of Saint Malo in Marie-Laure's room, and whisper to each other, and then tromp back downstairs. They ask a total of one question about three free French flags rolled up in a second-floor closet. Why does Etienne have them?
You put yourself in jeopardy keeping those, says the second policeman.
You would not want the authorities to think you are terrorists, says the first. People have been arrested for less.
Whether this is offered as favor or threat remains unclear. Marie-Laure thinks, do they mean Papa? The policemen finish their search and say good night with perfect politeness and leave. Madame Manette lights a cigarette. Marie-Laure's stew is cold. Etienne fumbles with the fireplace grate. He shoves the flag one after another into the fire.
No more, no more, he says, the second louder than the first. Not here.
Madame Manette's voice.
They found nothing. There is nothing to find.
The acrid smell of burning cotton fills the kitchen. Her great-uncle says,
You do what you like with your life, madame. You have always been there for me, and I will try to be there for you. But you may no longer do these things in this house, and you may not do them with my great-niece.
To my dear sister Jutta, it is very difficult now. Even paper is hard to XXXX censor marks XXXX. We had XXXX censor marks here, XXX. No heat in the XXXX censor marks here, XXX. Friedrich used to say there is no such thing as free will and that every person's path is predetermined for him, just like XXXX censor marks here, XXXX, and that my mistake was that I XXXX censor marks here, XXXX censor marks, XXXXX censor marks, 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 XXXX. I hope someday you can understand. Love to you and Frau Elena, too. Sieg Heil.
The frog cooks. In the weeks to come, Madame Manette is perfectly cordial. She walks with Marie-Laure to the beach most mornings, takes her to the market, but she seems absent, asking how Marie-Laure and Etienne are doing with perfect courtesy, saying good morning as if they are strangers. Often she disappears for half a day. Marie-Laure's afternoons become longer, lonelier. One evening, she sits at the kitchen table while her great-uncle reads aloud.
The vitality which the snail's eggs possess surpasses belief. We have certain species frozen in solid blocks of ice, and yet regain their activity when subjected to the influences of warmth.
Etienne pauses.
We should make supper. It doesn't appear that Madame will be back tonight.
Neither of them moves. He reads another page.
They have been kept for years in pillboxes, and yet, on subjecting them to moisture, have crawled about, appearing as well as ever. The shell may be broken, and even portions of it removed, and yet, after a certain lapse of time, the injured parts will be repaired by a deposition of shelly matter at the fractured parts.
There is hope for me yet, says Etienne, and laughs, and Marie-Laure is reminded that her great-uncle was not always so fearful, that he had a life before this war and before the last one, too, that he was once a young man who dwelled in the world and loved it as she does. Eventually, Madame Manette comes through the kitchen door and locks it behind her, and Etienne says good evening rather coldly, and after a moment, Madame Manette says it back. Somewhere in the city, Germans are loading weapons or drinking brandy, and history has become some nightmare from which Marie-Laure desperately wishes she could wake. Madame Manette takes a pot from the hanging rack and fills it with water. Her knife falls through what sounds like potatoes, the blade striking the wooden cutting board beneath.
Please, madame, says Etienne, allow me. You are exhausted.
But he does not get up, and Madame Manette keeps chopping potatoes, and when she is done, Marie-Laure hears her push a load of them into the water with the back of her knife. The tension in the room makes Marie-Laure feel dizzy, as if she can sense the planet rotating.
"Sink any U-boats today?" murmurs Etienne. "Blow up any German tanks?"
Madame Manette snaps open the door of the icebox. Marie-Laure can hear her rummage through a drawer. A match flares, a cigarette lights. Soon enough, a bowl of undercooked potatoes appears before Marie-Laure. She feels around the tabletop for a fork, but finds none.
"Do you know what happens, Etienne," says Madame Manette from the other side of the kitchen, "when you drop a frog in a pot of boiling water?"
"You will tell us, I am sure."
"It jumps out. But do you know what happens when you put the frog in a pot of cool water and then slowly bring it to a boil? You know what happens then?"
Marie-Laure waits. The potatoes steam. Madame Manette says,
"The frog cooks."
Orders. Werner is summoned by an 11-year-old in full regalia to the commandant's office. He waits on a wooden bench in a slowly building panic. They must suspect something. Maybe they have discovered some fact about his parentage that even he doesn't know. Something ruinous. He remembers when the lance corporal came through the door of Children's House to escort him to Herr Seidler's, the certainty that the instruments of the Reich could see through walls, through skin, into the very soul of each subject. After several hours, the commandant's assistant calls him in and sets down his ballpoint and looks across his desk as though Werner is one among a vast series of trivial problems he must put right.
"It has come to our attention, cadet, that your age has been recorded incorrectly."
"Sir?"
"You are 18 years old, not 16, as you have claimed."
Werner puzzled. The absurdity is plain. He remains smaller than most of the 14-year-olds.
"A former technical sciences professor, Dr. Hauptmann, has called our attention to the discrepancy. He has arranged that you will be sent to a special technology division of the Wehrmacht."
"A division, sir?"
"You have been here under false pretenses." His voice is oily and pleased, his chin non-existent.
Out a window, the school band practices a triumphal march. Werner watches a Nordic-looking boy stagger beneath the weight of a tuba.
"The commandant urged disciplinary action, but Dr. Hauptmann suggested that you would be eager to offer your skills to the Reich."
From behind his desk, the assistant produces a folded uniform, slate gray, eagle on the breast, Litzen on the collar, then a green-black coal scuttle helmet, obviously too large. The band blares, then stops. The band instructor screams names. The commandant's assistant says,
"You are very lucky, cadet. To serve is an honor."
"When, sir?"
"You'll receive instructions within a fortnight. That is all."
Pneumonia. Breton Spring, and a great onslaught of damp invades the coast. Fog on the sea, fog in the streets, fog in the mind. Madame Manette gets sick. When Marie-Laure holds her hand over Madame's chest, heat seems to steam up out of her sternum as though she cooks from the inside. Her breathing devolves into trains of oceanic coughs.
"I watch the sardines," murmurs Madame, "and the termites and the crows."
Etienne summons a doctor who prescribes rest, aspirin, and aromatic violet comfits. Marie-Laure sits with Madame through the worst of it, strange hours when the old woman's hands go very cold and she talks about being in charge of the world. She is in charge of everything, but no one knows. It is a tremendous burden, she says, to be responsible for every little thing, every infant born, every leaf falling from every tree, every wave that breaks onto the beach, every ant on its journey. Deep in Madame's voice, Marie-Laure hears water, atolls and archipelagos and lagoons and fjords. Etienne proves to be a tender nurse. Washcloths, broth, now and then a page from Pasteur or Rousseau, his manner forgiving her all the transgressions past and present. He wraps Madame in quilts, but eventually she shivers so deeply, so profoundly, that he takes the big heavy rag rug off the floor and lays it on top of her. "Dearest Marie-Laure, your parcels arrived, two of them dated months apart. Joy is not a strong enough word. They let me keep the toothbrush and comb, though not the paper they were wrapped in, nor the soap. How I wish they would let us have soap. They said our next reposting would be to a chocolate factory, but it was cardboard. All day we manufacture cardboard. What do they do with so much? All my life, Marie-Laure, I have been the one carrying the keys. Now I hear them jangling in the mornings when they come for us, and every time I reach in my own pocket, only to find it empty. When I dream I am in the museum. Remember your birthdays? How there were always two things on the table when you woke? I'm sorry it turned out like this. If you ever wish to understand, look inside Etienne's house, inside the house. I know you will do the right thing, though I wish the gift were better. My angel is leaving, so if I can get this to you, I will. I do not worry about you, because I know you are very smart and keeping yourself safe. I am safe, too, so you should not worry. Thank Etienne for reading this to you. Thank in your heart the brave soul who carries this letter away from me and on its way to you. Your Papa. Treatments. Von Rumpel's doctor says that fascinating research is being done on mustard gases, that the anti-tumor proprieties of any number of chemicals are being explored. The prognosis is looking up. In test subjects, lymphoid tumors have been seen to reduce in size, but the injections make Von Rumpel dizzy and weak. In the days following, he can hardly manage to comb his hair or convince his fingers to button his coat. His mind plays tricks, too. He walks into a room and forgets why he's there. He stares at a superior and forgets what the man just said. The sounds of passing cars are like the tines of forks dragged along his nerves. Tonight he wraps himself in hotel blankets and orders soup and unwraps a bundle from Vienna. The mousy brown librarian has sent copies of the Tavernier and the Streeter and even, most remarkably, stenciled duplicates of de Bott's 1604 Gemarum e Lapidium Historia, written entirely in Latin, everything she could find concerning the Sea of Flames. 9 paragraphs total. It takes all his concentration to bring the text into focus. A goddess of the earth who fell in love with a god of the sea, a prince who recovered from catastrophic injuries, who ruled from within a blur of light. Von Rumpel closes his eyes and sees a flame-haired goddess charge through the tunnels of the earth, drops of flame glowing in her wake. He hears a priest with no tongue say, "The keeper of the stone will live forever." He hears his father say, "See obstacles as opportunities, Reinhold. See obstacles as inspirations." Heaven. For a few weeks, Madame Manette gets better. She promises Etienne she will remember her age, not try to be everything to everyone, not fight the war by herself. One day in early June, almost exactly 2 years after the invasion of France, she and Marie-Laure walked through a field of Queen Anne's lace east of St. Malo. Madame Manette told Etienne that they were going to see if strawberries were available at the Saint-Servin market. But Marie-Laure is certain that when they stopped to greet a woman on the way here, Madame dropped off one envelope and picked up another. At Madame's suggestion, they lie down in the weeds, and Marie-Laure listens to the honeybees mind the flowers and tries to imagine their journeys as Etienne described them, each worker following a rivulet of odor, looking for ultraviolet patterns in the flowers, filling baskets on her hind legs with pollen grains, then navigating drunk and heavy all the way home. How do they know what parts to play, these little bees? Madame Manette takes off her shoes and lights a cigarette and lets out a contented groan. Insects drone, wasps, hoverflies, a passing dragonfly. Etienne has taught Marie-Laure to distinguish each by its sound.
What's a Roneo machine, madame?
Something to help make pamphlets.
What does it have to do with that woman we met?
Nothing to trouble yourself over, dear.
Horses nicker and the wind comes off the sea gentle and cool and full of smells.
Madame, what do I look like?
You have many thousands of freckles.
Papa used to say they were like stars in heaven, like apples in a tree.
They are little brown dots, child, thousands of little brown dots.
That sounds ugly.
On you, they are beautiful.
Do you think, madame, that in heaven we will really get to see God face to face?
We might.
What if you're blind?
I'd expect that if God wants us to see something, we'll see it.
Uncle Etienne says heaven is like a blanket babies cling to. He says people have flown airplanes 10 kilometers above the earth and found no kingdoms there, no gates, no angels.
Madame Manette cracks off a ragged chain of coughs that sends tremors of fear through Marie-Laure.
You are thinking of your father, she finally says. You have to believe your father will return.
Don't you ever get tired of believing, madame? Don't you ever want proof?
Madame Manette rests a hand on Marie-Laure's forehead, the thick hand that first reminded her of a gardener's or a geologist's.
You must never stop believing. That's the most important thing.
The Queen Anne's lace sways on its taproots, and the bees do their steady work. If only life were like a Jules Verne novel, thinks Marie-Laure, and you could page ahead when you most needed to and learn what would happen.
Madame.
Yes, Marie.
What do you think they eat in heaven?
I'm not so sure they need to eat in heaven.
Not eat? You would not like that, would you?
But Madame Manette does not laugh the way Marie-Laure expects her to. She doesn't say anything at all. Her breath clatters in and out.
Did I offend you, madame?
No, child.
Are we in danger?
No more than any other day.
The grasses toss and shimmy. The horses nicker. Madame Manette says, almost whispering,
Now that I think about it, child, I expect heaven is a lot like this.
Friedrich. Werner spends the last of his money on train fare. The afternoon is bright enough, but Berlin seems not to want to accept the sunlight, as though its buildings have become gloomier and dirtier and more splotchy in the months since he last visited, though perhaps what has changed are the eyes that see it. Rather than ring the bell right away, Werner laps the block 3 times. The apartment windows are uniformly dark. Whether unlit or blacked out, he cannot tell. At a certain point on each circuit, he passes a storefront filled with undressed mannequins, and though he knows each time that it is merely a trick of the light, he cannot stop his eyes from seeing them as corpses strung up by wires. Finally, he rings the bell for number 2. No one buzzes down, and he notices from the nameplates that they are no longer in number 2. Their name is on number 5. He rings. A returning buzz issues from inside. The lift is out of order, so he walks up. The door opens. Franny, with the downy face and swinging flaps of skin under her arms, she gives him a look that one trapped person gives another. Then Friedrich's mother swishes out of a side room wearing tennis clothes. "Why, Vanna!" She loses herself momentarily in troubled reverie, surrounded by sleek furniture, some of it wrapped in thick wool blankets. Does she blame him? Does she think he is partially responsible? Perhaps he is. But then she comes awake and kisses him on both cheeks, and her bottom lip quivers lightly, as if his materialization is preventing her from keeping certain shadows at bay.
"He won't know you. Don't try to make him remember. It will only upset him. But you are here. I suppose that's something. I was about to go. Very sorry I cannot stay. Show him in, Franny."
The maid leads him into a grand drawing room, its ceilings a swirl with plaster flourishes, its walls painted a delicate eggshell blue. No paintings have been hung yet, and the shelves wait empty and cardboard boxes stand open on the floor. Friedrich sits at a glass-topped table in the back of the room, both table and boy looking small amid the clutter. His hair has been combed hard to one side, and his loose cotton shirt has bunched up behind his shoulders so that his collar is skewed. His eyes do not rise to meet his visitors. He wears his same old black-framed glasses. Someone has been feeding him, and the spoon rests on the glass table, and blobs of porridge cling to Friedrich's whiskers and his placemat, which is a woolen thing featuring happy, pink-cheeked children in clogs. Werner cannot look at it. Franny bends and pushes three more spoonfuls into Friedrich's mouth and wipes his chin, folds up his placemat, and walks through a swinging door into what must be a kitchen. Werner stands with his hands crossed in front of his belt. 1 year, more than that. Friedrich has to shave now, Werner realizes, or someone has to shave him.
"Hello, Friedrich."
Friedrich rolls his head back, looks toward Werner through his smudged lenses down the line of his nose.
"I'm Werner. Your mother said you might not remember. I'm your friend from school."
Friedrich seems not so much to be looking at Werner as through him. On the table is a stack of paper, on top of which a thick and clumsy spiral has been drawn by a heavy hand.
"Did you make this?"
Werner lifts the topmost drawing. Beneath that page is another, then another, 30 or 40 spirals, each taking up a whole sheet, all in the same severe lead. Friedrich drops his chin to his chest, possibly a nod. Werner glances around, a trunk, a box of linens, the pale blue of the walls and the rich white of the wainscot. Late sunlight glides through tall French windows, and the air tastes of silver polish. This fifth-floor apartment is indeed nicer than the second-floor one, the ceilings high and decorated with punched tin and stucco flourishes, fruits, flowers, banana leaves. Friedrich's lip is curled and his upper teeth show, and a string of drool swings from his chin and touches the paper. Werner, unable to bear it a second longer, calls for the maid. Franny peeks out of the swinging door.
"Where," he asks, "is that book, The One with the Birds, in the gold slipcover?" "I don't think we ever had a book like that."
"No, you did." Franny only shakes her head and laces her fingers across her apron. Werner lifts the flaps of boxes, peering in.
"Surely it's around here?"
Friedrich has begun to draw a new spiral on a blank sheet.
"Maybe in this?"
Franny stands beside Werner and plucks his wrists off the crate he is about to open.
"I do not think," she repeats, "we ever had a book like that."
Werner's whole body has started to itch. Out the huge windows, the lindens toss back and forth. The light fades. An unlit sign atop a building 2 blocks away reads, "Berlin smokes Junos." Franny has already retreated back into the kitchen. Werner watches Friedrich create another crude spiral, the pencil locked in his fist.
"I'm leaving Schopfwater, Friedrich. They're changing my age and sending me to the front."
Friedrich lifts the pencil, studying, then reapplies it.
"Less than a week?"
Friedrich works his mouth as if to chew air.
"You look pretty," he says.
He does not look directly at Werner, and his words are close to moans.
"You look pretty, very pretty, Mama." "I'm not your Mama," hisses Werner.
"Come on now." Friedrich's expression is entirely without artifice. Somewhere in the kitchen, the maid is listening. There is no other sound, not of traffic or airplanes or trains or radios or the specter of Frau Schwarzenberger rattling the cage of the elevator. No chanting, no singing, no silk banners, no bands, no trumpets, no mother, no father, no slick-fingered commandant dragging a finger across his back. The city seems utterly still, as though everyone is listening, waiting for someone to slip. Werner looks at the blue of the walls and thinks of birds of America, yellow-crowned heron, Kentucky warbler, scarlet tanager, bird after glorious bird, and Friedrich's gaze remains stuck in some terrible middle ground, each eye a stagnant pool into which Werner cannot bear to look. Relapse. In late June 1942, for the first time since her fever, Madame Manek is not in the kitchen when Marie-Laure wakes. Could she already be at the market? Marie-Laure taps on her door, waits 100 heartbeats. She opens the rear door and calls into the alley. Glorious, warm June dawn. Pigeons and cats. Screech of laughter from a neighboring window.
"Madame!"
Her heart accelerates. She taps again on Madame Manek's door.
"Madame!"
When she lets herself in, she hears the rattle first, as though a weary tide stirs stones in the old woman's lungs. Sour odors of sweat and urine rise from the bed. Her hands find Madame's face, and the old woman's cheek is so hot that Marie-Laure's fingers recoil as though scalded. She scrambles upstairs, stumbling, shouting, "Uncle! Uncle!" The whole house turning scarlet in her mind, roof turning to smoke, flames chewing through the walls. Etienne crouches on his popping knees beside Madame, then scurries to the telephone and speaks a few words. He returns to Madame Manek's bedside at a trot. Over the next hour, the kitchen fills with women. Madame Rouet, Madame Fontenot, Madame Ebrard. The first floor becomes too crowded. Marie-Laure paces the staircase, up and down, as though working her way up and down the spire of an enormous seashell. The doctor comes and goes. The occasional woman closes her bony hand around Marie-Laure's shoulder, and at exactly 2 o'clock, by the bonging of the cathedral bells, the doctor returns with a man who says nothing beyond good afternoon, who smells of dirt and clover, who lifts Madame Manek and carries her out into the street and sets her on a horse cart as though she is a bag of milled oats, and the horse's shoes clop away, and the doctor strips the bedsheets, and Marie-Laure finds Etienne in the corner of the kitchen, whispering, "Madame is dead. Madame is dead." 6. 8 August 1944. Someone in the house. A presence. An inhalation. Marie-Laure trains all of her senses on the entryway 3 flights below. The outer gate sighs shut, then the front door closes. In her head, her father reasons, the gate closed before the door, not after, which means, whoever it is, he closed the gate first, then shut the door.
He's inside. All the hairs on the back of her neck stand up. Etienne knows he would have triggered the bell at Marie. Etienne would be calling for you already. Boots in the foyer, fragments of dishes crunching underfoot. It is not Etienne. The distress is so acute, it is almost unbearable. She tries to settle her mind, tries to focus on an image of a candle flame burning at the center of her ribcage, a snail drawn up into the coils of its shell. But her heart bangs in her chest, and pulses of fear circle up her spine, and she is suddenly uncertain whether a sighted person in the foyer can look up the curve of the stairwell and see all the way to the third floor. She remembers her great uncle said that they would need to watch out for looters, and the air stirs with phantom blurs and rustles, and Marie-Laure imagines charging past the bathroom into the cobwebbed sewing room here on the third floor and hurtling herself out the window. Boots in the hall, the slide of a dish across the floor as it is kicked. A fireman, a neighbor, some German soldier hunting food. A rescuer would be calling for survivors, ma chérie. You have to move, you have to hide. The footfalls travel toward Madame Monek's room. They go slowly. Maybe it is dark. Could it already be night? 4 or 5 or 6 or a million heartbeats roll by. She has her cane, Etienne's coat, the 2 cans, the knife, the brick, model house in her dress pocket, the stone inside that, water in the tub at the end of the hall. Move. Go. A pot or pan, presumably knocked off its hook in the bombing, wobbles on the kitchen tiles. He exits the kitchen, returns to the foyer. Stand, ma chérie, stand up now. She stands. With her right hand, she finds the railing. He is at the base of the stairs. She almost cries out, but then she recognizes, just as he sets his foot on the first stair, that his stride is out of rhythm. 1, pause, 2. 1, pause, 2. It is a walk she has heard before, the limp of a German sergeant major with a dead voice. Go. Marie-Laure takes each step as deliberately as she can, grateful now that she does not have her shoes. Her heart knocks so furiously against the cage of her chest that she feels certain the man below will hear it. Up to the fourth floor, each step a whisper. The fifth. On the 6th floor landing, she pauses beneath the chandelier and tries to listen. She hears the German climb 3 or 4 more stairs and take a brief asthmatic pause. Then on again. A wooden step complains beneath his weight. It sounds to her like a small animal being crushed. He stops on what she believes is the 3rd floor landing, where she was just sitting. Her warmth still there on the wood floor beside the telephone table. Her dissipated breath. Where does she have left to run? Hide. To her left waits her grandfather's old room. To her right waits her little bedroom, the window glass blown out. Straight ahead is the toilet. Still the faint reek of smoke everywhere. His footfalls cross the landing. 1, pause, 2. 1, pause, 2. Wheezing, climbing again. If he touches me, she thinks, I will tear out his eyes. She opens the door to her grandfather's bedroom and stops. Below her, the man pauses again. Has he heard her? Is he climbing more quietly? Out in the world waits a multitude of sanctuaries, gardens full of bright green wind, kingdoms of hedges, deep pools of forest shade through which butterflies float, thinking only of nectar. She can get to none of them. She finds the huge wardrobe at the far end of Henri's room and opens the 2 mirrored doors and parts the old shirts hanging inside and slides open the false door Etienne has built into its back. She squeezes into the tiny space where the ladder rises to the garret. Then she reaches back through the wardrobe, finds its doors,
and closes them. Protect me now, Stone, if you are a protector. Silently, says the voice of her father, make no noise. With one hand, she finds the handle Etienne has rigged onto the false panel on the back of the wardrobe. She glides it shut, 1 centimeter at a time, until she hears it click into place, then takes a breath and holds it for as long as she can. The death of Walter Bernd. For an hour, Bernd murmured gibberish. Then he went silent, and Volkheimer said, God have mercy on your servant. But now Bernd sits up and calls for light. They feed him the last of the water in the first canteen. A single thread of it runs down through his whiskers, and Werner watches it go. Bernd sits in the glimmer of the field light and looks from Volkheimer to Werner.
On leave last year, he says, I visited my father. He was old. He was old all my life. But now he seemed especially old. It took him forever just to cross his kitchen. He had a package of cookies, little almond cookies. He puts them out on a plate, just the package lying crosswise. Neither of us ate any. He said, you don't have to stay. I'd like you to stay, but you don't have to. You probably have things to do. You can go off with your friends if you want to. He kept saying that.
Volkheimer switches off the light, and Werner apprehends something excruciating held at bay there in the darkness.
I left, says Bernd. I went down the stairs and into the street. I had nowhere to go, nobody to see. I didn't have any friends in that town. I had ridden trains all goddamn day to see him, but I left just like that.
Then he's quiet. Volkheimer repositions him on the floor with Werner's blanket over him, and not long afterward, Bernd dies. Werner works on the radio. Maybe he does it for Jutta, as Volkheimer suggested. Or maybe he does it so he does not have to think about Volkheimer carrying Bernd into a corner and piling bricks onto his hands, his chest, his face. Werner holds the field light in his mouth and gathers what he can, a small hammer, 3 jars of screws, 18-gauge line cord from a shattered desk lamp. Inside a warped cabinet drawer, miraculously, he discovers a zinc-carbon 11-volt battery with a black cat printed on its side, an American battery, its slogan offering 9 lives. Werner spotlights it in the flickering orange glow, amazed. He checks its terminals, still plenty of charge. When the field light battery dies, he thinks, we'll have this. He rights the capsized table, sets the crushed transceiver on top. Werner does not yet believe there is much promise in it, but maybe it's enough to give the mind something to do, a problem to solve. He adjusts Volkheimer's light in his teeth, tries not to think about hunger or thirst. The stoppered void in his left ear, Bernd in the corner, the Austrians upstairs, Friedrich, Frau Elena, Jutta, any of it. Antenna, tuner, capacitor. His mind, while he works, is almost quiet, almost calm. This is an act of memory. 6th floor bedroom. Von Rumpel limps through the rooms with their faded white moldings and ancient kerosene lamps and embroidered curtains and Belle Epoque mirrors and ships in glass bottles and push-button electrical switches all dead. Faint twilight angles through smoke and shutter slats in hazy red stripes. Temple to the Second Empire, this house. A bathtub 3/4 full of cold water on the 3rd floor. Deeply cluttered rooms on the 4th. No dollhouses yet. He climbs to the 5th floor, sweating, worrying he got everything wrong. The weight in his gut swings pendulously. Here's a large, ornate room crammed with trinkets and crates and books and mechanical parts. A desk, a bed, a divan, 3 windows on each side, no model. To the 6th floor. On the left, a tiny bedroom with a single window and long curtains. A boy's cap hangs on the wall at the back, looms a massive wardrobe, mothballed shirts hung inside. Back to the landing. Here's a little water closet, the toilet full of urine. Beyond it, a final bedroom. Seashells are lined along every available surface, shells on the sills and on the dresser, jars full of pebbles lined up on the floor, all arranged by some indiscernible system. And here, here, here on the floor at the foot of the bed sits what he has been searching for, a wooden model of the city, nestled like a gift, as big as a dining table, brimming with tiny houses. Except for flakes of plaster in its streets, the little city is entirely undamaged, the simulacrum now more whole than the original, a work of clear magnificence. In the daughter's room, for her, of course. Von Rumpel feels as if he has come triumphantly to the end of a long journey, and as he sits on the edge of the bed, twin flares of pain riding up from his groin, he has the curious sensation of having been here before, of having lived in a room like this, slept in a lumpy bed like this, collected polished stones and arrayed them like this, as though somehow this whole set has been waiting for his return. He thinks of his own daughters, how much they would love to see a city on a table. His youngest would want him to kneel beside her. Let's imagine all the people having their supper, she say. Let's imagine us, Papa. Outside the broken window, outside the latch shutters, St. Malo is so quiet that Von Rumpel can hear the rustle of his own heartbeat shifting hairs on his inner ear, smoke blowing over the roof, ash falling lightly. Any moment the guns will start again, gently now. It will be in here somewhere. It's just like the locksmith to repeat himself. The model, it will be inside the model. Making the radio. One end of wire, Werner crimps around a shorn pipe standing diagonally up from the floor. With spit, he wipes clean the length of the wire and coils it 100 times around the base of the pipe, making a new tuning coil. The other end he slings through a bent strut, wedged into the congestion of timber, stone, and plaster that has become their ceiling. Volkheimer watches from the shadows. A mortar shell explodes somewhere in the city, and a flurry of dust sifts down. The diode goes between free ends of the two wires and meets the leads of the battery to complete the circuit. Werner runs the beam of Volkheimer's light over the entire operation. Ground, antenna, battery. Finally, he braces the flashlight between his teeth and raises the twin leads of the earphone in front of his eyes and strips them against the threads of a screw and touches the naked ends to the diode. Invisibly, electrons bumble down the wires. The hotel above them, what is left of it, makes a series of unearthly groans. Timber splinters as though the rubble teeters on some final fulcrum, as though a single dragonfly could alight on it and trigger an avalanche that will bury them for good. Werner presses the bud of the earphone into his right ear. It does not work. Well, unfortunately, we've come to the end of the book hour and today's reading of All the Light You Cannot See by Anthony Doerr. Preceding program was a production of Sight into Sound Radio.